Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sunday, North Korea says it successfully conducted a test of a hydrogen bomb, the country's sixth nuclear test and its most powerful. Already high tension has risen higher. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. saying North Korea's Kim Jong-un is begging for war. The U.S. Secretary of Defense speaking of a massive, overwhelming military response, total annihilation. This hour On Point, real options now on North Korea. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is the way here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times. His story in today's paper headlined, U.S. urges fuel cutoff for North Korea, saying it's begging for war. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. David Sanger, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be back with you, Tom.
We've just got you for a few minutes here. First, on the North Korean claim of a hydrogen bomb having been tested, I guess it is clear that it was a very strong blast. Seismic detectors around the world and experts who follow this have told us so. But is the Trump administration persuaded it was indeed a hydrogen bomb?
They don't seem to know yet. And, you know, there are a number of way stations along the way to a hydrogen bomb, what's called a boosted weapon, where they take an element called tritium and use that to increase the yield of a bomb. And so it could be any of those stages along the way. But here's what we do know, because politically I'm not sure it makes that big a difference whether it's a hydrogen bomb or not. What we do know is that it was 6 to 10 times larger than anything they've tested before, and the largest they've tested before was roughly Hiroshima-sized. So this enters them into the club of very serious nuclear players.
They also released photographs of what was said to be the bomb itself, illustrating that it would fit in the nose cone of an intercontinental ballistic missile, they said. How credibly is that threat, that assertion, taken?
Well, when you looked at the picture of Kim Jong-un, the country's president and dictator, examining this weapon, it looked the right shape. It looked a lot like what a sort of two-stage hydrogen bomb would look like on the outside, but it could very well have been a mock-up, and it could have been a scale model. So we don't know whether they've accomplished the last two things they would need to do to have a completely deliverable weapon, and that is to have it small enough to fit in the nose cone, as you said, and to make it survivable enough so that when an intercontinental ballistic missile re-enters the atmosphere after being cast out into space, that the weapon can survive the vibration, the heat of re-entry. And so those are the last two big obstacles. And the question is, have they passed them now, as some in the intelligence community think they probably have, or do they believe that that's still 6 months, a year, 2 years away, which would give the U.S. a little bit of time, but not much.
Emergency meetings then over the weekend at the UN indicating that certainly this is being taken very seriously, and the rhetoric at the UN and beyond certainly as high as it's ever been. Nikki Haley saying they're begging for war. Secretary of Defense James Mattis talking about a massive military response, total annihilation, saying he doesn't want it, but putting that on the table, that horrible phrase that always comes with North Korea. What does all this mean in terms of the balance of military readiness for? Are we talking about readiness for war, or are we talking about more rhetoric to try and push the North Koreans to stand down? Please interpret what we're hearing, David.
It's hard to interpret, Tom, and it's hard because if you want a diplomatic solution with the North Koreans, the best way to get there is to make them convinced that you are, in fact, ready to execute a military option. The big debate is, do we really have a military option? First of all, they've got a lot of missiles and a lot of nuclear material now, much more than they had 5 or 10 years ago. So while there may have been a military option in, say, 2007, it's not clear there is one today. We don't know where everything is, and a lot that they have seems to be held in underground bunkers, in caves. They're using solid fuel missiles, which means that they can put those in a cave and roll them out and be able to launch them very quickly. So it would be a big job just finding everything. Then comes the second question out of all of this, which is, even if you knew where everything was and thought you could hit it, could you prevent the North Koreans from doing a counterstrike against Seoul using conventional weapons, just the artillery along the demilitarized zone? And the answer, and every time people have wargamed this, is no, you couldn't stop massive casualties in Seoul. So the North Koreans have sort of brilliantly exploited this to sort of say, you guys don't have a military option against us, thanks to the geography of the Korean Peninsula. So you might as well just accept that we have a nuclear weapon. And that's the big debate right now. Should the United States simply say that it accepts that North Korea is now a nuclear power, the way we accepted Russia and China and then later Pakistan and India, as nuclear states? And so far, the administration's position is no, we will never acknowledge them as a nuclear power.
Is the Trump administration handling this substantially differently from previous administrations?
Well, I have some sympathy with the Trump administration when the president says that every one of the past four presidents, I would say it may even go back a little further than that, has kicked this can down the road, because they have. With every incremental increase in the North Korean nuclear capability, each president who's looked at this, from George H.W. Bush to Clinton to George W. Bush and then President Obama, they have looked at this and they have said, you know, this incremental improvement is not worth risking war on the Korean Peninsula. It's not worth risking Seoul. And if you add up all of those incremental improvements over 25 years, what you get is what you have today, which is a North Korea that has missiles that can pretty convincingly reach parts of the United States, perhaps not with accuracy, but should be able to reach there, and a significant, if small, nuclear arsenal. So then the question is, do you now say we're going to break with the past practice and really have a confrontation with these guys, or is it simply too late to do that? And there's a significant argument to be made that it's too late.
Nikki Haley said, look, it's time for last-ditch diplomatic efforts here. They're talking about cutting off fuel. I guess you call that diplomatic, but that's pretty elemental. Is there consensus among world powers that could lead to such a squeeze being put on North Korea that it would, in fact, back away from this program?
Well, you know, everybody can have an opinion on this, but there's only one opinion that counts, and it's the Chinese. Because the pipeline that feeds North Korea most of its oil runs right from China, and China is responsible for well over 90% of North Korea's oil supplies. If the Chinese ever decided to turn that off, I think you would have a sanction that would make North Korea actually have to go pay attention. The Chinese view until now has always been that they do not want to do anything that would lead to the collapse of the regime, to South Korea being able to take over the territory of the north and move up right onto the Chinese border that would trigger a humanitarian crisis where the North Koreans, without energy, without food, would flow into China. So the Chinese simply don't want it. And what you're seeing happen differently this time is that the Trump administration is trying to make the case to the Chinese that the cost of not cutting them off will ultimately be greater than the cost of cutting them off. And I don't know if they can make that argument.
This is a wild poker game. David Sanger with the New York Times, thank you very much for being with us. No game in the end at all, but still, there is brinkmanship on an incredible level going on here. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Hear the sound of a North Korean state news channel, a reader, on Sunday announcing, they said, that North Korea had successfully conducted a test of a hydrogen bomb.
대륙간 탄도 로켓 장착용 수소탄 시험에서의 완전 성공은
Saying here, the perfect success in the test of the H-bomb for the intercontinental ballistic missile clearly proved that the nukes of the North Korea have been put on a highly precise basis, the credibility of the operation of the nuclear warhead fully guaranteed, and the design and production, all that with a lot of gusto there out of North Korea. Serious? Well, here was Yukiya Amano. This is the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying the latest nuclear test by North Korea poses, yes, a more significant threat.
Now, it is a concern over nuclear weapons combined of missiles. The threat related to DPRK is a very grave threat that reached to a new dimension.
DPRK, that is North Korea. We've got a lot to look at here. Barbara Demick joins us right now, New York correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, former head of bureaus in Beijing and in Seoul, South Korea. Author of Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. Barbara, thanks very much for being with us. Welcome back to On Point. Are we on new ground here, or is it the same dynamic playing out again?
Well, thanks. Happy to be here. It is the same dynamic playing out here, but it keeps on getting more and more dangerous as their nuclear and missile program become more credible. And in a way, we've been, beaten down by all these North Korea crises. We used to joke it was like Groundhog Day. You know, every time they made a new threat, people would, sort of shrug it off. Certainly the South Koreans would shrug it off. But, it may have gotten to the point where we can no longer do that. As Nikki Haley said, we can't kick it down the road anymore because there's no more road left. They have a serious nuclear weapon.
But is war a real possibility here?
I don't think that's what anybody wants. I don't think that's what the North Koreans want. But it's not difficult to see how we could go down that path.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a North Korea the U.S. says is now begging for war. As North Korea itself says, it now has a deliverable hydrogen bomb. Claims. You can join us this hour. What do you see emerging here? What is the path to a diplomatic solution? Can you spot one? Could we really, really be looking at war with all of the implications of that with North Korea? In response to North Korea's latest nuclear test, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting yesterday. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, said North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is begging for war.
His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war. War is never something the United States wants. We don't want it now. But our country's patience is not unlimited. We will defend our allies and our territory.
Begging for war, says the UN ambassador for the U.S. there. And already we have the defense secretary kind of talking like, look, if you want it, you can have it. We're ready. Here was Secretary of Defense James Mattis.
Any threat to the United States or its territories, including Guam, or our allies, will be met with a massive military response, a response both effective and overwhelming.
And there was more. He talked about the total annihilation of a country, namely North Korea.
All members unanimously agreed on the threat North Korea poses, and they remain unanimous in their commitment to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Because we are not looking to the total annihilation of a country, namely North Korea. But as I said, we have many options to do so.
There, the U.S. Secretary of Defense Barbara Demick is with us. She's former head of news bureaus in Beijing and in Seoul. Close, right on the lip of it all, players in this current drama. With the Los Angeles Times, joins us from New York today. With us from Washington as well is Keir Lieber, professor at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service in the Security Studies program there. Keir Lieber, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
James Mattis says right there, we have a lot of options to execute the total annihilation of North Korea. Is that true?
Well, look, I mean, you get past the hot rhetoric, you're now on both sides, and of course it's clear that the United States has military options. The question is, how good are those options, and what costs are we willing to bear in undertaking those military strikes?
How do you play this game of brinksmanship without ending up in a conflict that everybody says would be absolutely devastating, including for some of the very closest allies of the United States, and at some point for American forces themselves?
Well, if I'm honest, I find U.S. policy a little confusing at this point. In fact, I would have expected maybe a military strike already, given the statement that if North Korea poses a threat, the U.S. won't tolerate that. I just think there are two pathways to war. One, to nuclear war. One is a conventional conflict on the Korean Peninsula that breaks out in one way or another, and that escalates to nuclear war. That would probably escalate through North Korean use of nuclear weapons to bring a halt to the war before it's too late. And the second path to war is a U.S. preemptive, preventive strike. And again, that, you know, most analysts today are skeptical that that can be done without resulting in catastrophic damage. Again, I'm not so sure. I think it's, you know, they're classified information, and I'd have to hear the briefing. But it certainly is not an option that at this point I think I would, if I were president, want to pursue.
Does that mean then, does that boil down to the United States, despite the rhetoric, accepting North Korea as a nuclear-armed, maybe hydrogen-bomb-armed player?
Well, again, this is the part that's confusing to me. If it were my choice, I think we're already at a point where we have to learn to live with a nuclear North Korea. But the rhetoric coming out of Washington and the U.S. statements seem to me inconsistent with that acceptance.
You're talking about the president here. He said fire and fury if the U.S. was threatened, and I guess that North Korea is kind of threatening.
Again, a little late for that. Again, I don't want to. It's not as if I want to compel the president into taking catastrophic military action just because he made a threat. But the point is, what's the strategy here? The diplomatic path, the sanctions path, the oil cutoff. This is not going to happen. It's not going to be effective. North Korea is not giving up its nuclear weapons. So the question is, do you learn to live with the nuclear North Korea, or do you take military action to stop it? If the Trump administration is planning to use military action, if all else goes wrong, again, I'm slightly surprised they haven't already done so, and maybe that they're gearing up to do so now.
Vladimir Putin saying in China today that everybody should aim for dialogue with North Koreans. Here he was, Russian President Putin.
We should aim toward that all participants, including North Koreans, will not have any thought of threat of their destruction, that all parties will get on the path of cooperation. And in this situation, to force military hysteria is a dead-end road.
To force military hysteria, kind of criticism there of the United States and North Korea, both, but being Putin, probably the U.S. But it's not just the Russian leader. Here was Republican Texas Senator Ted Cruz on ABC's This Week yesterday, voicing his opposition to military action on North Korea. This is Ted Cruz.
No rational person wants to see a military conflict with North Korea. With the nuclear weapons there, almost any scenario, you're looking at tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of casualties in a matter of days.
It is just mind-boggling, and if you know the geography of the Korean Peninsula, you know just how close the South Korean capital, with its millions of residents, its incredibly hard-won, sophisticated economy built up over decades there, just miles from the border with North Korea, and all the artillery there at the ready. Lots of callers for you, Keir Lieber and Barbara Demick. Stephen in Montreal in Canada. Stephen, thank you for your call. You're on the air.
Hi. Okay. My concern is, so many pundits, including Fareed Zakaria, good ones, constantly say that their nuclear program is all about survival of the regime. But some have said not. And I would believe that. I lived in South Korea for 10 years. I believe that it's very possible it's about changing the map in the long run.
You mean the North taking over the South or something like that? Is that what you mean, Stephen?
Well, take, for example, the Northern Limit Line. I was there in 2010 during the attack. Currently, South Korea vows a massive response if there is another attack there. Perhaps in several years, when North Korea's nuclear systems are reliable and effective, not like now, but they will be, they'll push for territory once again in that area. South Korea has vowed to respond, you know, three times as hard. And they'll have to follow through. They will have to follow through on that.
Stephen, let us pick it up right there. You're referring back to November 2010 when there was artillery engagement between the North and South there along the border. Things got pretty fraught. Barbara Demick, how do you see North Korea's goal here? Is it, you know, don't mess with us, we have nukes, or might it be we still want this whole peninsula and we are arming up steadily over decades with that goal in mind?
Well, thanks. I think this is an excellent question because, you know, the conventional wisdom, I've typed this so many times, is that North Korea is using its weapons program to ensure regime survival.
Yep.
So they can't be taken out like Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein. That's we've all written that.
Mm-hmm.
But their persistence does raise the serious question about whether they have a larger motive in mind and whether they still believe in reunification by force, which, you know, their rhetoric is that they're the rightful government of all of the Korean Peninsula. I don't think so, because I don't think they have the capability of carrying that out. But I think you cannot rule out that their ambitions are larger than we once thought.
Keir, Nikki Haley says it's time to go the last mile on diplomatic efforts here. What does that look like if we did everything possible diplomatically to create leverage to turn this around? What reasonably might that look like, and does it have any reasonable chance of success with Pyongyang?
Again, it depends on what your measure of success is. If it's convincing Kim to give up his nuclear weapons program, I think it's a hopeless path. If it's muddling through with diplomacy for the next few years and proposing sanctions that are essentially violated, et cetera, yeah, we can go on for a while longer. The question is, most of the countries involved in this, like China and Russia that you mentioned, would like to keep the status quo, have no interest in rolling back North Korea's program. North Korea, of course, is not going to accept denuclearization. It's not clear that the United States is willing to take military action to stop North Korea from doing so. So this could muddle through, but I find it hard to believe that we can continue on like this. Just one quick thing in response to Barbara. What else is worth persistence than seeking to ensure your survival with nuclear weapons? Sometimes the simplest explanation is the right one. North Korea wants nuclear weapons to prevent an outcome that occurred with Gaddafi and with Saddam and a countless number of countries that have been attacked and conquered because they didn't have nuclear weapons. It's persistent pursuit of this goal makes complete sense to me, and I don't see why you need to add on additional arguments about blackmail or conquering the Korean Peninsula.
Well, maybe because what we're talking about here is accepting or not accepting a nuclear-armed North Korea. And in that context, it's one thing if all they want to do is be left alone. Okay, you can be left alone, step out of the circle, and, you know, total annihilation, James Mattis says. But if what they have in mind is the conquest of the entire Korean Peninsula, then we have an ally directly in harm's way. That's a very different situation, is it not, Keir?
I'm not minimizing the threat. The issue is, can South Korea defend itself, and can it defend itself with U.S. help? I think it's a no-brainer. The conventional balance of power is a complete mismatch. There's no scenario in which North Korea conquers South Korea. And the question is, if we were happy to live with a North Korea that would live by itself, That might be the outcome. If it gets nuclear weapons and you maintain the status quo, at that point, the main thing you want to do is prevent, do whatever you can to prevent a conventional war from breaking out. Because as I said, if a conventional war breaks out, that's a war that North Korea is going to lose. And if North Korea loses, Kim knows his fate, and he wants to avoid that fate. That's why nuclear weapons make sense.
Barbara Demick, that suggests that, in fact, though they may like to have the entire Korean Peninsula, it does come back to them just wanting to be secure within their own borders. If a conventional war or a conflict with the South would, you know, mean their ultimate defeat, maybe that's a recipe for accepting nukes there.
Well, you know, again, we haven't, you know, we will probably never say we accept North Korea as a nuclear power, but it is a de facto nuclear power now, and we know it. The North Koreans do want to ensure regime survival. They also want to improve their economy. You know, the North Koreans frequently say what they're going to do. You know, all this stuff you read about how inscrutable they are, and you know, I don't think that's the case. They signal or state very clearly, and Kim Jong-un very early adopted this slogan "Byungjun," meaning parallel paths, simultaneous. They want to use the nuclear program to build their economy, which, you know, seems like a contradiction. But actually, their economy is growing. You know, that's the funny thing, despite all these sanctions. And I think Kim Jong-un does eventually want to seek some sort of tacit approval of his nuclear program, a lifting of sanctions so they can go forward economically.
Jake in New Orleans. Jake, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I have a question about options I'd like to ask your guest.
Okay.
The first is whether a radio-free Europe type of communication program constantly being beamed into North Korea could lead to some breakthrough over time. But then secondly, as in the Cuban Missile Crisis, what about a blockade of North Korea in which the vessels would be in international waters, but we'd take no other action other than to keep vessels and particularly ones coming from supplies coming in and out of North Korea.
Well, I mean, bear in mind, Jake, most importantly there is that North Korea has a long and very robust border with China, and that's where most of the trade happens. But, of course, the president, the U.S. president, Donald Trump, over the last few days has said, well, we may cut off trade with anybody who trades with North Korea. Keir Lieber, what about the options for trade leverage? Lots of people came back and said, Mr. President, what are you talking about? You're going to cut off all American trade with China to try and bottle up North Korea, not to mention the rest of North Korea's trading partners. But Jake is wondering about a kind of stranglehold here. Is that conceivable? The president seems to be trying to threaten it.
I think those options are unrealistic, and they're unrealistic because China has no incentive to destabilize North Korea through an economic blockade or an oil blockade or anything like that. And we should probably ask ourselves whether we want an effective blockade, given what happened with Japan in World War II and the attack on Pearl Harbor after the oil embargo.
We cut off oil to Japan, and the next thing you knew, we were at war with Japan.
Yeah, and again, these are not comparable cases, but the point is, be careful what you wish for. You know, we clearly, the best outcome here might be to have an internal coup and through destabilization that way, but you're not going to get that from cutting off food to the North Korean people.
Fuel, that's what the U.S. is now calling for. Is there any chance of that, cut off of fuel care?
Again, China is the key player here, and if China has no incentive, and in fact, not only no incentive not to cooperate, they're opposed to that. They're opposed to taking actions which would destabilize North Korea immediately on their border in a way that could lead to, you know, South Korea moving all the way up to Pyongyang and the United States living on its border. That's the outcome that it cannot accept. It would much prefer a nuclear North Korea to anything like that outcome.
Barbara, no incentive, Keir says. On the other hand, Donald Trump named James Mattis, a.k.a. Mad Dog Mattis, to be Secretary of Defense. He's known as a very aggressive military leader when things get rolling. Can the U.S. freak China out enough with the prospect of maybe a crazy but possible military conflagration here?
I think yes. I think China is pretty freaked out. I'll just point out a couple of things about China. Their 19th Party Congress is taking place next month, and this is a very big deal for them. Mm-hmm. And it's not a time that they want trouble. But down the road, I think they might get tough.
Get tough on North Korea or in response to the U.S.?
Get tough on North Korea. I think they're not happy with North Korea.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a North Korea the U.S. says is now begging for war, as North Korea says it now has a deliverable hydrogen bomb. Here's sound from Monday as the South Korean military launched a ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan, part of a live fire exercise meant to, it said, strongly warn North Korea. And here was South Korea's ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador there, saying, begging for war. This is Cho Tae-yul at the U.N. Security Council yesterday, asking Security Council members for a new, much tougher resolution against their northern neighbor, North Korea.
The new resolution must include not only additional measures to further block funds that could possibly flow into North Korea's illegal WMD program, but also truly biting and robust measures that Pyongyang finds very painful.
South Korea says bring on the pain, biting and robust sanctions. Barbara Demick was bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Seoul, the South Korean capital, and in Beijing in China. Joins us today from New York. Keir Lieber is looking at this from the Security Studies Program at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. You can join us. Is the Trump administration right to be talking about war here? How do we dial this down safely, or should we dial it down? Jody in Smithfield, Tennessee. Jody, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I may be underreacting, but the way I'm looking at it is it would be foolish for Kim Jong-un to fire at us, because should we engage in a war and our missiles or Kim Jong-un's missiles land in Japan or China or wherever, the consequences, if he starts it, who's going to finish it? And where will it be finished? I'm not worried about our security as much as I would be China's or Russia's or anywhere else, because once those missiles start flying, it could get out of hand, and everybody over there is going to pay the consequences. So I'm wondering, are we overreacting, or is it just me?
Well, and of course, James Mattis describing total annihilation, and he's talking about North Korea there, if it should ever come to that. I mean, Keir, is the bottom line here that the same kind of mutually assured destruction, or in this case, just North Korea's destruction, because they don't have what it would take to destroy the United States, they're not Russia, they're not China, does that mean that there's a limit on any nuclear aggression that could ensue from North Korea?
Well, I think the degree to which someone's confident or truly worried about conflict looming, it depends on your faith in deterrence. I personally think nuclear weapons do one thing really well, which is to deter attack. However, we know from the Cold War, we know from other arms competitions, that it's not as if the game ends when two sides have nuclear weapons. The United States is deeply interested in building the capabilities that would be necessary for disarming North Korea if it decided to escalate or use nuclear weapons. And North Korea has great interest in developing and deploying the kinds of systems that would survive a disarming strike like that. So the game doesn't end as soon as two states become nuclear powers. So I do have great faith in deterrence, but if one wants to suggest that security competition and arms competition will end once the United States accepts a nuclear North Korea, I think that's also wrong.
But Jody's looking, Barbara, and saying, well, look, why would they take out, you know, L.A. or Seattle if it would mean the end of their country? Let's settle down here.
You know, if Jody could see me here, she'd see that I was nodding as she was speaking. I don't think personally that North Korea has any incentive to start a nuclear confrontation. I don't think they would, you know, attack Seattle or San Francisco or, for that matter, even Guam. But at the same time, I don't think you can look at the paradigms of the Cold War this is just a very different situation with a much smaller enemy, if we're going to put them that way, that is directly threatening the U.S., at least in their rhetoric. I mean, they are threatening to use offensive capability, and that didn't happen in recent memory with the Soviet Union.
Robert in Toronto. Robert, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi. The Koreans, the North Koreans, are targeting the U.S. power grid with a single hydrogen weapon exploded high enough that it would down the entire U.S. power grid and the communications and IT infrastructure. Okay, we may need to do that to them before they can do it to us. And what I mean is, if we have a tactical small nuclear weapon that could do the same thing to North Korea without damaging South Korea's power system or the Chinese power system, we should do it. Now, this doesn't kill people. It wipes out the electronic infrastructure, the economy. So, yes, everything collapses. Now, the North Korean population has somewhere to flee. They can flee to China, and they can flee to South Korea. They can survive. The entire North American population has nowhere to go if the Koreans did that. So maybe this is our unique opportunity to respond. Yep. With, you know, the plus of tactical nuclear weapons was they harm property.
Robert, we've got it. Let me look at it. I mean, let us look at it here. It sounds like a tall order. It sounds kind of James Bond. And you talk about North Koreans fleeing. That's 25 million people. But, Kier, is there some kind of, you know, magic technology here that could send an electromagnetic pulse through North Korea and fry everything, not hurt South Korea, look, take out their nukes?
Look, there are two issues here. First, to clarify, it's U.S. conventional power that is threatening to North Korea more than its nuclear weapons. In other words, it's the fear of conventional defeat in war that's driving North Korea to want to have nuclear weapons in the first place. So it's good old traditional conventional power that's a threat. The second issue is, what kinds of capabilities would the United States use in a disarming strike against North Korea, either before North Korea began to escalate or after it began to escalate? And there the answer is, it's probably going to be all of the above. It's going to be cyber. It's going to be conventional. Again, if North Korea has begun to escalate or is using nuclear weapons and there are things you can't do with conventional, then the United States might be willing to use low-yield, highly accurate nuclear weapons. But they're pretty much going to need to throw the kitchen sink at this problem if the United States wants to avoid terrible consequences for U.S. allies in the region in particular.
But Barbara, the last time the U.S. sent to war on the Korean Peninsula, it was a real meat grinder. I mean, it was hand-to-hand, and it was hell. Would it be different this time if it's conventional conflict, which is North Korea's big fear? Is the U.S. really up for that these days?
I don't think the U.S. is up for that. You know, it would be, I think, a much shorter war and possibly a deadlier war. I don't think that's what anybody wants.
When you say deadlier, do you mean it would go nuclear? Or because they've got a large army themselves, and they've got people with not a lot to lose.
That's right. That's right. Well, there's bigger weapons, and I don't think you would see as much hand-to-hand combat, but there's just a much not to speak of nuclear weapons, there's a much larger conventional arsenal, and this could be a very nasty war, even if it was a short war. I mean, we've talked about this many times before. Their conventional artillery, the North Koreans' conventional artillery at the DMZ could, you know, easily cause, you know, tens of thousands of deaths in Seoul in a few days. Seoul is only, I think, 35 miles mm-hmm. away. So you'd have a very, very nasty war, even if ultimately, and I'm sure we would, ultimately prevail.
Kier, is that so clear that it would be nasty and short? I mean, again, the last time out, China got involved in a hurry, and it was not ultimately winnable for the United States. There's still no formal peace there. We sort of drew a line down the middle of the peninsula and lived with it. Nasty and short, is that clear? I mean, it's incredible we're even talking about it, but that's the language coming out.
Well, short is anybody's guess. The issue here is it's going to look very different than war in the 1950s. In the first hours of any outbreak of conventional conflict, the United States and the Combined Forces Command with South Korea are going to be hitting North Korea and all kinds of North Korean targets, including air defenses, command and control, nuclear command and control, and, of course, the artillery threat to the south. But that, there's no – anytime you look at the possible mission, it's a very big mission, very big operation. As I said, at the same time, you're trying electronic warfare, cyber, et cetera. So the question is, would the United States and South Korea win a conventional war against North Korea? For sure. The balance of power is too asymmetric.
What about North Korea plus China? Because China came right in last time.
Sure. I mean, it's a real danger. I think at that point, you know, the United States is already attacking targets in Pyongyang. And so that by the time China sends in ground forces, the idea that somehow this is going to be crossing the Yalu River and engaging U.S. forces in conflict seems implausible to me. But it's all going to happen very quickly. And again, the biggest danger is that in the midst of that conventional war, North Korea has huge incentives to use a nuclear weapon, possibly against Japan, maybe over the East Sea or Sea of Japan, maybe against a U.S. Base in the region, and with the threat that if the United States doesn't stop the war, it will use more. I think that's a huge threat.
I'm not sure China would stay on the sidelines. I don't know why it would be any more likely to sit on the sidelines in wartime than it would be, you know, it's determined, you say, in peacetime not to have an American ally right on its border. But here we are, and it's all cranked up. Wes in Nashville. Wes, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love the show. Forget what the diplomats and the generals, and with all due respect, what your guests say, the crazy like a fox strategy doesn't work if your leaders are actually crazy. I'm scared to death that Trump is going to start a nuclear war with his Twitter account. After North Korea's missile launch last week, Trump tweeted, "Time for talk is over." Haley said, "North Korea is begging for war." I mean, does anyone realize the gravity of that language? I'm afraid Trump is begging for war.
We had Senator Corker talking about the stability of the president not so long ago. Over the weekend, we had former Senator Max Baucus of Montana. He was the U.S. ambassador to Beijing for 3 years during the Obama years. And he was talking with Rachel Martin on NPR's Morning Edition today about whether Washington and Pyongyang are really ready for war.
Nikki Haley said the North is begging for war. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis says that the U.S. will have to issue a military response. Is the Trump administration running the risk of sending empty threats when the North continues to...
Oh, yes, no question. Absolutely. I don't think North Korea is begging for war. I don't agree with that. It is an empty threat.
An empty threat. I mean, who's pushing this now, Barbara? North Korea is not on the sidelines. They're saying we got a hydrogen bomb, and they're talking about intercontinental missiles. The U.S. has got rhetoric that's just about as fierce as the North Korean language, what we used to kind of laugh about. Our caller's worried about stability on both sides.
That's right. If you ask South Koreans, they're more worried about Trump as the unpredictable one than they are about Kim Jong-un. The North Koreans have been making these kind of threats for decades, and they've learned to live with it. But, you know, I think you have a very dangerous dynamic here where you have, the Trump administration, you know, in effect borrowing the rhetoric of the North Koreans, you know, threatening to cause these conflagrations and seas of fire. And, you know, it doesn't seem to be working. It doesn't seem to be making the North Koreans back down. It makes them more fearful of their regime survival and has, caused the acceleration of their weapons program. It's a very dangerous situation. I don't think it is being handled well.
Keir, are you confident that there's a steady hand on the U.S. side of this equation behind the hot rhetoric?
No. The hot rhetoric is clearly not helpful. I think the only thing that's worth acknowledging, though, is that this is a real – it's a dilemma. There wouldn't be international politics if there wasn't a serious dilemma here. That said, so this would be a hard one for any, even the most adept president and set of advisors. The second thing is, as I said, and I refer this to the caller, maybe didn't hear it, but yeah, I find U.S. Policy and strategy at this point rather confusing. If they're contemplating military action, it seems to me that you're getting close to the point of fish or cut bait. And they can't possibly think there's going to be a solution through the sanctions and any other diplomatic steps. And that leaves the third option. Figure out some way, get some fancy lawyers and advisors to come up with some fancy language to justify why the United States can live with a nuclear North Korea. I don't really see that happening either. So to me, Trump policy on North Korea at this point is an enigma.
Last one, caller, Jim in Kent, Ohio. Jim, you're on.
I agree with the previous caller that I think Trump is more of a concern in this situation than the North Korean leader. We need to remember as Americans that in the 1950s, by 1953, we had bombed every city in North Korea and killed millions of the people. And so it should be kind of understandable why they don't want us conducting military exercises along their border.
Yeah, but we've got an ally there as well. What would you do now, Jim?
I would cut bait. I would get the hell out of North Korea. We don't belong there.
You mean out of South Korea? Get out of Korea entirely?
Yeah, just like Vietnam. We got out of there. We said we win. We left. Look how much better off the Vietnamese are since we got out of there, even though the North took over.
Jim, our time is short, but we've got it. Is that an option, Barbara? The U.S.? I mean, hey, goodbye, South Korean ally. You're on your own. You can handle North Korea. Do it.
Well, you know, North Korea is threatening us in a way. We have inserted ourselves into this conflict. We're far from North Korea. But they also keep us in this conflict. It's a very complicated situation. I mean, anti-Americanism is the force that gives North Korea meaning. You know, I don't know that they will have an incentive to really solve this conflict. If they're no longer, you know, at war with the United States, why do we have a North Korea? You know, they why not just a South Korea, which is a prosperous, free country?
Yeah, but we've had guests on this show in South Korea saying, no, the North still wants the South. They want to own the whole show. Kir Lieber, could you see the U.S. just leaving this to the South Koreans and the North to work out? So long. Adios.
It is entirely possible. It's entirely possible. If you don't like what you see, coming, that issue, the United States pulling out of East Asia entirely and letting Japan and South Korea handle their own defense is a real possibility. It's one that's not being debated enough.
It sounds kind of like a Donald Trump formulation, despite the saber rattling right now. Let them pay for it. Let them do it.
Why Trump's policy is confusing at this point.
Wow. Okay, there we are, begging for war, says the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and you've heard the discussion of it right here, right now. Kir Lieber at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, thank you very much for being with us, Kir.
Thanks, Tom.
And Barbara Demick, a longtime bureau chief in Beijing and Seoul, now New York correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.